Okay, sorry. I'm actually going to get you to stand up for a second. Have a stretch. Just sitting there for any length of time is. And I'm not doing this, I'm doing research on sedentary behaviour, so it's really important to keep getting up and moving about. While you're standing up, just give yourself a little bit of room. That might mean moving your chair back a little bit. Okay, I'm going to get you to try and stand on one leg. Don't mind which one it is. Feel how much hard work your ankle's doing. Now close your eyes for me. Good, I've got most of you to wobble a bit. Can you swap over and use your other leg? Because you'd have picked your best one automatically. Okay, close your eyes as soon as you're stable. Good, just wanted you to test your own balance before we started. Right, you can sit down again. So, as you heard from Leanne, there are many, many reasons for falls. But what I've just tried to get you to think about is that one of the main reasons when people fall is they're moving. And they're often turning, or their feet have come together for something, or they're getting out of the way of something, so their base of support is affected. And as you will see, and I'm sure you remember when you were a kid, you quite happily stood on one leg in the playground, or walked backwards, or, you know, it didn't cross your mind. But believe it or not, even at your age, you're starting to decline in balance function, as you've probably already felt that. Now, for many of you, as soon as you close your eyes, you have to put a foot down, or you wobbled a lot more. And that's because vision is one of our main inputs for balance. And because it's one of our main inputs, if we've got vision, we start relying on it more and more. So people who are blind have got really good balance. They've been blind from birth. They've got exceptionally good balance because they use all the other systems to keep them upright. They don't rely on their vision, whereas we do, if those of us have got a reasonable sight. So one of the main reasons that many older people become fallers, it's not always a medical reason, it's quite often it's unfitness. It's balance has got so poor that you just blow a gust of wind on them and they're going to fall over. So one of the reasons that exercise comes up as a key intervention to reduce falls is to retrain balance, which can be retrained unless someone has a progressive neurological disease, and then it becomes quite difficult. Even in people with dementia, you can retrain balance. They don't know you're doing it or remember you've done it, but their balance does actually get better. So part of the talk through before the break is going to be for you to start thinking more about physical fitness and function. More importantly also, how do we get people who are very frail, haven't left the house for some time, very fearful? If you tell them to go and meet physical activity guidelines and do 150 minutes of moderate activity in a week, they'll just laugh at you. Of course they're not going to do that. So it's different strategies that you could use to get them to start practicing their strength and balance safely, and ways at which you can embed that into their everyday life so it becomes a habit to do it, like cleaning your teeth, as opposed to an intervention that they have to put time aside for. Okay, these are a series of falls which are captured and appear on YouTube, as you can see. So this first one, okay. So turning, just a reminder, I'm just going to show you the next one, that's nice. Just various different circumstances for falls, and some of these you'll look at them and go, oh, so we need to train her to actually take a step as she turns, you know, these are the sorts of things. Okay, these are a much more functional group, gone to visit somebody, but, and of course backward sideways falls nearly always break a hip. This guy's obviously having some fun with his Christmas decorations and someone's engaging him in activity, which is all good. You'll see, very obvious, his feet just get tangled. And in fact, if you look at any research with fallers, whereas you and I might be able to cross a leg over and do a step if we go from being knocked sideways, they don't. The foot just comes and hits. They don't actually take the foot round, for example. Oh no, that's definitely not. That was definitely not the right one. Okay, so did we see all of those? I don't think we did. Let me just check the last one. I think there's at least one more that I wanted to show you. Yeah. And this one you'll see. This is what I call a patient precocious parking. She's so desperate to sit down because she's got to fall. Nobody put the brake on the set of. Very simple things, but these are transitions, moves, things which you and I would not hit the floor, and neither would a fitter older person. So a lot of this is just to do with physical function. So before it goes off into some other weird. Okay, right. Those things are preventable if the person hadn't been allowed to get quite so frail in the first place. You're not going to stop all falls, because some falls are blackouts, some falls are strokes, some falls are heart attacks. There's all sorts of, somebody has severe vestibular dysfunction, you're going to have a lot of trouble with that. But the vast majority of falls are frailty. They're to do with frailty. And so one of the key things we need to do is look at how can we engage people, because you can't just give someone a pill, unfortunately. It'd be lovely if you could. You've got to get them to move. And they've got to move regularly and often in order to build muscle. So just to give you an idea of that, if you lay somebody flat for a week, catheterize them, so they don't move for a week, they will lose 20% of their muscle strength. One-fifth in 1 week. So, of course, as soon as we have this culture of not moving, as soon as we get older, which we do, you will see this loss, active loss of muscle. You lose 1% of bone density in a month. And it takes, believe me, exercise, hard work exercise, takes you a year to get that back. So what we don't want is people to sit and be inactive. They have to keep moving. They don't necessarily have to do everything to a high intensity. We just have to be on our feet more when we get to that age. So a few more figures that Leanne covered some of this, but these are very up-to-date figures in Scotland on falls. So a couple of things to point out. This is the worst thing that could possibly happen to a faller, that they end up in hospital, because an average of 19 days in hospital, okay, so that's 3 weeks of not moving, because people don't get mobilised regularly in hospital, so they move even less than they did when they were at home. So you will get a decline in function in that time period. If they've had a fracture, obviously it's going to be quite hard to mobilise them, depending on what the fracture is. Who is working in orthopaedics? Somebody, so you'll know how hard it is to get anybody up after they've had a hip fracture or a knee replacement or anything along those lines. It's pretty, the older they are, the harder it is to get them to mobilise. But this is a very sad state of affairs when 40% of them can't go home. And that's because there's no care package in place. And actually, the longer they stay in hospital waiting for the care package, the worse they get. And it's a really horrible, vicious cycle. So, in terms of costs, in an ideal world, we want to, for the NHS system, we need to stop hip fractures. They're the things that really, really cost, and the vast majority of people, sadly, following hip fracture, don't get back to pre-fracture mobility. Any idea what's the easiest way of preventing a fractured hip? Has anybody ever come across hip protectors? Nobody talks about them, nobody knows about them anymore, do they? A few years back, 10, 15 years back, everybody and their dog got given a hip protector, because there was a series of studies, and these are a pair of not very sexy pants with things that sit over the greater trochanter, so that as you fall, it moves the impact away. It doesn't absorb it. It depends which one is a harder or a soft one, but there was a variety of different ones out there. And those, if they're worn, do an amazing job at stopping hip fractures. The problem is that people don't wear them. And then the next few studies where they did intention to treat, and most people didn't have them on when they fell, they were sort of thrown out with the bathwater, sadly, because they do still have a place for some people. The other main way of stopping a hip fracture is giving somebody back their reaction skills to get the hand out. So when you and I fall, we get a hand out. And we really hurt the wrist or the arm or whatever, but we get something out to break the fall. As soon as you're not fit and active, the hand doesn't go anywhere, and you just go smack, as you saw in all of those falls. Not one did somebody try and get a hand out and stop anything. And that's reaction time, and that's fitness. So that's partly why I keep coming back to the fact we often forget, and we get so entranced with medication reviews, with fall alarms, and I get why we do that for some, because it takes a while. You can't, unfortunately, click your finger and they're fit in a week. It takes a lot longer. But we often forget and get so distracted and risk-averse, we get everyone sitting, and actually it's just going to make it worse. They're just going to fall more frequently. Every time they transfer, they'll start falling. So we do need to be considering physical activity and movement. As you heard from Leanne, long lies are a problem. I haven't seen any recent figures on this, but some 15, 20 years ago there was a paper that came out that basically showed that probably a third of all deaths due to falls were people that had a long lie, there was no injury. There was nothing that was preventing them from getting up, they just couldn't get up. And because in the UK we have such a large group of older people that live on their own, they were dying as a result of the fall purely because they couldn't get up. Now, luckily, falls, alarms and everything else mean that's far less likely to happen. But it still can if they won't press it, because some of them don't. So why can somebody not get up? Back to fitness. It's purely knowing which muscle group to use when, which position to put your foot in. It's practice, actually. So often it's not even strength, it's just practicing that movement pattern again. So all these things are really important to think about when you have someone, particularly a regular faller, in front of you. You may not. My gran was a regular faller. The last 3 to 4 years of her life, I swear to God, she fell practically every day. But she was a really good faller. So she never broke anything, including falling backwards down a flight of stairs. Still to this day, don't know how she didn't break anything, but she didn't. So she just relaxed into it and laughed, and by the time she'd hit the bottom, was laughing even louder. But she could get up until about the last 6 months of her life, and then she couldn't get up off the floor. And at that point, we were coming home from work, and she'd been at the bottom, you know, lying there for some time. Usually wet herself, so the indignity had set in, you know, etc. And she started really avoiding activity. And that's the point at which, if you have somebody who is a faller, and the only scare is them not being able to get back up again, then it's something that's really important to retrain with them. Physios can lead on that, exercise instructors can lead on that, but actually a lot of it, again, is not to do with not having the right muscles working, it's practice the same task over and over. So my jokey thing when somebody says to me they're starting to have difficulty with something as they get older, is say, oh good, practice it, do it twice as often, because it then won't be difficult. So that's all it is retraining something that you're avoiding. And of course, a lot of these older people are just above this sort of dependent line of suddenly needing help. And it can be anything, as we see. It can be a urinary tract infection, a cold, all sorts of things. Even the death of a family member, where they then go into grieving for a few weeks and don't move, that can tip them to suddenly becoming dependent in a task they were fine with before. And yes, given time and movement, they will normally somewhat get back up to that. Obviously, there are various interventions that you can do. Either it's supported in early discharge and do some work with them at home or whatever. But the problem is we have a habit of just leaving them there and then going away, and then we come back a year later because they've just got back into this again. What we don't do is get them up here, which gives them that additional resilience to fight the urinary tract infection. Do you see what I mean? So what we do is we do enough just to get them back into some movement. We don't get them up into actually being resilient. And then in a few years' time, that's not going to be an issue. Okay, so you've just had a go with your own strength and balance on your feet, with using your feet. But of course, many of the reasons that older people become less active is that they find that environment out there quite risky. So either they can't see it very well. These are great. These are for visually impaired older adults to tell them where the end of the pavement is. The trouble is that the vast majority of other older adults won't walk on it because it's so uncomfortable on the feet and their balance is so affected. So they cross the road in unsafe places rather than crossing there. So what we do for one person in the environment doesn't necessarily suit the next one, as I'm sure you've come across in many of the newspaper articles. Ankles and feet are particularly interesting. So, for example, there is one large intervention, another one just about to get published, which just did exercise of the feet. Nothing else, just sitting exercises with the feet, and they reduce falls. Because actually, if you think about it, well, you just felt just then, how much work did your ankle have to do to keep you upright? Now, okay, a lot of old people aren't going to stand there on one leg, but they are walking, and for that point, during the walking cycle, they're on one foot a lot of the time. So that strength in that ankle complex, so the plantar dorsiflexion, inversion, eversion, are really key to how you first react when you start to lose your balance. And if you haven't got enough strength in those muscles to keep you upright, you have to put your foot down. which is what some of you did. And that, again, shouldn't be happening at your age. It's because we tend to avoid doing anything that makes us feel too wobbly. Okay, so at some point, taking aside medical reasons for falls, at some point, instead of becoming a tripper, we become a faller, so we no longer can correct that perturbation or that knock. And you'll see that, as I mentioned just now, with fracture sites. So younger, older people, when they fall, will still often break a wrist or an upper limb. And the older you get, you stop seeing any wrist fractures and it just becomes hip fractures. And that's again to do with reaction time and physical activity. So Cochrane reviews. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. But these are the key, this is what informed the COT guidelines. So the COT guidelines have then translated this information from the Cochrane into something that OTs can do for each of those settings and each of those instances. So a couple of things. First of all, exercise is key, as you can see. And the other main key thing is your home safety intervention. And something that we come back to that Leanne said earlier, it's not all about the assessment. It's about what you do with the assessment. And interestingly, there are so many completely unsuccessful trials out there because the whole thing's been about the assessment and not enough thought has been into what the intervention is or whether they do it and adherence to it. So it's really quite key. Multifactorial assessment, in other words, thinking wider than just exercise or just medication review, thinking of those wider inputs, will help reduce your rate of falls. So if you've got a faller that's had a couple of falls in the last year, the chances are you'll reduce the number of falls they'll have in the next year. Won't necessarily stop them falling. And actually, what's really a key thing, you will never stop everybody falling. I mean, if you think about that sort of in common sense-wise, just put your hands up in the room now. How many of you have had a fall in the last year for whatever reason? Could be skiing, could be you name it. Oh, God, you lot are really amazing. Oh, they're coming up now. Hang on. 4, 5, 6, 7, little one going up there. 8. Okay, we're already at a third of the room. So falls are normal. The problem is when you're frail and you fall, you can't get up or you hurt yourself more or fear sets in. So you can't stop falls, all falls. What you want to do is stop the ones that mean people no longer engage with society. Yeah, so you need to work on the fear, the ones that break a hip, and that sort of thing. Tai Chi, one of the key things of preventing the first fall, which is really interesting. So there's not a lot of evidence on that first fall prevention, or first injurious fall, should I say. So Tai Chi's got a lot of evidence base. It's helpful on mental health as well. But it doesn't work with a frail, older person. So you take someone who is not moving, uses a Zimmer frame, they cannot do the elements of Tai Chi that you need to do in order to prevent the fall, which is big three-dimensional movements, slow, controlled, strength work. As soon as somebody with a Zimmer frame is asked to do that, they're not going to do it. They're going to sit down or they're going to tighten up. So it works brilliantly in that people with balance and strength problems, but they're not really at the limit of frailty. One of the things interesting is that we still don't really have strong evidence that by reducing falls we actually reduce fractures. Now, common sense says you must do, because 95% of fractures are due to a fall. The other 5% are severe osteoporosis and twisting in bed and things, but essentially, or being smacked into by a car, but most fractures are due to falls. But no research trial yet has actually been big enough, because fractures are still quite rare, have been big enough to be powerful enough to actually say that definitely reduces fractures. I think we're getting quite close. I think the next year or so that advice is going to change because they're updating this at the minute. So just give you some ideas of numbers. What do we mean by a prevention of falls? So these are the number of trials that were in the particular Cochrane review. So 16 trials looked at group provision of exercise through fall services, falls clinics, etc. And there was approaching a 30% reduction in falls if you brought all those studies together. Home-based, these are still exercise programs, but where the person does it at home on their own, but with motivational support. That does not mean they get given a home exercise booklet and left to it. because then they don't do it. So the emotional and support strategies are really important. But again, around about 30%. Tai Chi, preventing your first lot of falls, around about the same, 30%. Fantastic. If you take Tai Chi at those not at risk, so they're really quite that normal aging, they're getting out and about doing things, it's perhaps a little bit greater in that respect. So blanket saying you roughly you could produce probably reduce about 30% of your falls rates with exercise of different forms. So then you start looking at some of your home safety stuff. Home safety, around about 20%. Now, that hides a multitude of sins. If you look at the ones that are delivered by occupational therapists, it's up at 30%. There's an awful lot of stuff recently being developed and delivered by non-OTs. And people are trained to do that, but they're trained literally to do that really in-depth assessment and then put a couple of handrails up. There's nothing in the coping strategy, the way somebody approaches their life, all that goal setting, that doesn't exist. So if it's delivered by an OT, far more effective. It goes so far as to say it's not effective at all if it's not delivered by an OT. And that's quite important because as we spend a lot of our time reaching out to other services because the number of older people is so large, and so talking about working with the ambulance services, fire and rescue, all sorts of other agencies coming in, yes, it's great to have them involved, but there still is no actual evidence that them delivering anything is going to be effective. We won't know until somebody's done a bit more research in that, but it's important.
I was just going to say, when you're saying that, I'm doing some work with Fire and Rescue just mm-hmm. now, and we're doing a DVD about home safety and about when there's a community action team from the fire service. They go out and they do home fire safety visits, and the idea was that they would look at falls as part of their home fire safety visit. What they would do in a home visit is slightly different to what we would do if we were going in as an OT, and that's become very apparent as we've gone and we've done this DVD together. But also as well, there's a bit about, well, they can see thousands of people within a year, so there's quite a number of them. So how can we utilise that as a resource so that they can then trigger a referral onto an occupational therapist where it's appropriate? So that's what we're trying to look at the minute, because there's not enough of us to be able to go and see all the people that need us, or that. So how do you use the assets that you've got in your community to be able to go out and look at home environment and then see, will that person really needs an OT to be going in?
So in other words, they do an early level screen and are finding the people, but then the OTs would go in and do the actual intervention. I think that's the important bit. And for example, in the Glasgow Falls Service, all those home visits are done by OT assistants, by technical instructors at that point. But they trigger the need for an experienced OT to go in and do a home intervention if necessary. They're not taking away the need for the OT at a later point.
And so the other bit of that was around post-discharge. Not everybody that's coming out of hospital will need a home visit, but how do we know who does? So if you built in a system where perhaps Fire and Rescue did it as a home fire safety visit, then you would then have a trigger that would say that. So again, it's thinking about who's the most appropriate to do that.
And one of the biggest issues we had in the early years of all these falls prevention interventions getting into place in the UK is all the services going, oh, don't open it up to everybody because we're going to get swamped. So actually they were managed as to who could refer into them for about the first 7 or 8 years, purely because they knew if it was open referral from everywhere, they wouldn't be able to cope with the numbers. And so, sadly, that was a restrictive aspect for many years as well. Okay, just running through these last few fairly quickly. Vitamin D. You heard earlier Leanne talking about, in Scotland we don't have very high levels of vitamin D. So that holiday once a year in the sun makes quite a big difference. But joking aside, vitamin D is not perfect for everybody either. So if someone has reasonable vitamin D levels, obviously that intervention is not going to work. It's only really suitable in people who are vitamin D deficient, so it's checked beforehand that they are deficient, Or, interestingly, irrespective of deficiency, any care home resident. Now, that's an interesting one. It's probably because actually almost every care home resident is vitamin D deficient because they don't go out anymore. You need to get out and get into supposed daylight, not be wheeled out into a conservatory, because that doesn't change the active form of vitamin D in your skin. So they actually need to get out, which is the other issue, because even if they're given a supplement, if they're not actually taken out, it doesn't necessarily become an active supplement.
Can that be compensated for with UV?
Yes, there is some research to show that the SAD, SAD? Seasonal affective disorder, that those lamps can make quite a big difference in turning the active form. So it's all about turning that vitamin D that you're ingesting or getting through the sun into an active form. So yes, there is, but it's all very small studies again. I mean, and also, what we don't know, because those lights for seasonal affective disorder don't just affect vitamin D; they do other things, serotonin and other levels. So you're never quite sure which bit. Researchers are never quite sure which bits have the effect, but certainly they do seem to make a difference in the amount of active vitamin D you've got in your blood. Okay. So you'll notice it says if a person is housebound, just assume a low level of vitamin D. Don't even bother going to take blood tests, etc. And particularly up in Scotland, I think that's even more. I'm going to move past that one, and I'm going to just pull out a couple of other things. So what I've just spoken to you about are the interventions for community dwelling, older people living in their own homes. So now let's look at the interventions that occur in nursing facilities, so care homes and in your hospital setting. This is one of the few places where exercise doesn't have an effect on its own. So exercise is not the be-all and end-all, and that's partly because you'll have a lot more health issues in this population group. That's why they're in care homes and in hospital, so that the medical reason for falls is usually much greater. Vitamin D is still in there. Multifactorial is still in there, the same as you saw with the community dwelling. And if you go into hospitals, now obviously some of this will depend on how long a patient's in for, but multifactorial interventions seem to work both in frequent fallers but also potentially the first really nasty fall. But sadly, they have to be in hospital for 45 days before that becomes an effective intervention. And I'm hoping you agree that you don't really want to keep them in hospital for that long just so you've got a bit of an effect with your multifactorial intervention. We're back again, though, here, in this setting. Exercise alone works. And yet they're in hospital, usually, for a medical reason. So it's interesting. Okay, I'm having a bit of a joke with you here, but the therapists that put those various studies together that have shown a reduction of falls with exercise in a hospital setting is that they reckon it wears the person out, so they're less likely to move and transfer for the rest of the day, and therefore they're not exposing themselves to as much risk. Simple as that. It's something to occupy them, because they get bored. When they get bored, they go wandering. So, and it's not fully that. The exercise is mimicking safe transfers, so technically as time goes on, they're going to get safer in the transfer from bed to chair or chair to toilet or whatever. And if you have a geriatrician involved, almost anywhere you're going to get better outcomes. And I'm sure many of you have come across the value of having geriatricians in those settings. And some emerging evidence about flooring. So concrete floors with carpet on, with lino on top, they're more likely to break a hip. If it's got a wooden floor with lino on top, they're less likely to break a hip. And that's interesting because, of course, to put hospitals up quickly, you just build them in concrete. But then if you lay a wooden floor on top of that and then a lino, you're less likely to get a fracture in that hospital setting. So there's some interesting stuff coming out there. Cost effectiveness at the moment is all around exercise or an OT delivering a home safety intervention. Those are the only intervention at the moment that have really been shown to be fully cost effective. I'm going to move past some of that. Okay. Just before we break... and we're going to give you a task to do in your break, I thought I would just get you upright and do a couple of the Otago exercises that are used in falls prevention with older people. Particularly, because I want you to have a think during the break as well, Some of these exercises, you can embed these into everyday lives. It doesn't have to become, I'm going off to do my exercise program or my intervention. And if anything, it's probably going to be more effective like that because it will become a habit. So the two main programs that are run in the UK are the Otago Home Exercise Program. Otago is a lovely place in New Zealand. It doesn't stand for anything else except a lovely place in New Zealand. And then there's the FAME program. Essentially, Otago is for your frailer, older adult. I'm being very generalised here, but essentially. And your FAME is for your slightly more active older adult. So that takes the balance challenge much higher. I'm not going to show you those because you're not going to be working with them. essentially, chances are these are people who are not seeing services much, starting to have falls, perhaps not able to get up off the floor. But what we do in FAME is we do introduce reskilling, getting up off the floor. So in the Glasgow service, they use a mix of both. And just to give you an idea, across the UK, 95% of services are using those two programmes, which is good because we're using evidence-based programmes. What we're not doing is following the actual evidence-based programme. We're saying we are. So we're handing out a home exercise booklet, or we're bringing them in for 6 weeks of group sessions. The evidence base, unfortunately, is much more complicated than that. So if you look at these two, Otago was originally a one-year programme, 1 year, not 6 weeks, and your FAME was originally a nine-month programme. So, luckily, we've now had a number of meta-analyses of these big research trials, and they are really quite clear that you'll only see a reduction in falls if you do at least 50 hours of challenging balance and strength work. There is no way you guys or anyone in the NHS is ever going to be able to deliver that. So the only way of making it effective in the long run is to change someone's habit and they automatically start doing it as part of their everyday life. Okay. So I'm going to get you to stand up and we'll just spend 5 minutes or so. Have a go. Now, I suggest just about more space probably if you push your chair under the table and you stand behind your chair. I've deliberately got you standing. You can, of course, start some of the exercise seated, but unless your exercise is in standing, you're not going to reduce falls. Falls do not occur while someone is sitting down. They occur when they're standing. So it's all those body bits they need to get in the right position to keep them in upright when they're not. So you've just tried a simple one earlier. We'll do it again. So stand on one leg. You can keep your eyes open this time. Lovely. And put the foot down. Now put one foot in front of the other, as if you're walking along a white line, a tightrope, touching heel, toe. Okay, now you are nice and stable, but just turn your head left and right and see how stable you are when you start doing that. Thought I'd throw you off, good. Because there I'm mucking up your other balance system, which is your vestibular inner ear. Okay, so first time I just took out your vision. Okay, can I get you all to face that side of the room? And go back into the heel-toe position. You're all facing that way, lovely. Now, very carefully, peel your front foot off the floor and bring it round to touch the back of your other foot. So you're doing a backwards heel-toe walk. Some of you are going to hit the wall in a minute. I'll stop them, don't worry. Right, you can stop. Okay. Feet back into tandem again, into parallel again. Don't move too far forward though. Stay back in the room. Okay. This time I want you to go up onto your toes. Keep your bottom in. Keep your tummy nice and tight. Lovely. So you're just on your toes. Now I'd like you to take three little steps forward. Just keep looking forward. Feet together and heels down. Lovely. Now bring your toes up off the floor so you're standing on your heels. A lot harder. Bottoms in, please. Anyone that's got heels, you're going to find this impossible. Okay, so you've got your toes up off the floor. Can you take three little steps backwards like that? Keep your toes off the floor. Great. Okay. Right, feet down again. Now face me for a second. Make sure you've got a chair in front of you. Now, I would not, of course, do this one where I'm bringing the toes up and doing backward walking. That would not be the first exercise I give a trainer or the person at home. That's something you progress to over a long time period. But the standing on one leg. Give me a place I can do that at home that I do on a regular basis in a day.
Sink.
Sink. Every time I wash up, perfect. Cleaning my teeth. So any time I stand in front of a sink, why don't I, for 30 seconds, just try and stand on one leg? Now, I might need to put a fingertip or two fingertips on, but you see what I mean? You can embed that so that every time they see a sink, they go, oh, must do a one-leg stand for a minute. Okay, great. That one when we were doing the heel-toe. Where might they do that? Can't do everything by the sink. They'll get bored by the sink. Anyone have it? How about every time they're on the phone? So every time the phone rings. Or every time they're waiting for the kettle to boil. Because they've got a nice long kitchen surface that they can hold on to if they need to, while they're waiting for the kettle to boil. They could even, because most kitchen surfaces are reasonable length, you could even get them to do a heel-toe walk along and back while they're waiting for the kettle to boil. So you can introduce these safely into their everyday life. Yeah? Okay, sit down again for a second.
I would have got them to do that when standing at the window.
At the window, being nosy outside, yeah? So just a couple of reminders before we give you your task for the break. Muscle strength is vital. It's vital for more than just moving the body. So imagine when you're cold, what do? Apart from putting extra clothes on, you shiver. And that's because you're producing heat. And the only way you can do that is to shiver, so otherwise get the muscles to do some work. So muscle size is really important, not just for keeping us upright, but actually also for maintaining core body temperature, which is why it's so hot in care homes, because they've got no muscle. So they just crank the heat up, because they can't produce internally as much heat. So strength training will help maintain your core temperature. And I always have a bit of a joke with older people. It means they can eventually they can turn their heating down and save some money. But they need to have muscle first to do that. It also helps infection control. So there is a very strong association with muscle size and the getting of infections, either in hospitals or hospital-acquired infections, but also urinary tract infections, flu, that sort of thing. So they're going to be healthier and fight off more if they've got bigger muscles. We're not talking about, you know, really big muscles. We're talking about just being able to see there's a muscle there and not just skin and bone. Balance, really important to prevent falls. But actually, almost anything you do in enjoyment terms in everyday life, so getting out, socialising, going to your local club, getting on the bus, all of these things need balance. Because you have to stand on one leg as you get up onto the bus. You have to go into someone's house. You have to go up their stairs to use their loo, because they're nearly always upstairs. So do we need strength and balance in order to enjoy life? So this is how you should sell it. It's not all about preventing falls. It's about maintaining and enjoying life a little bit better.
Going back to the yellow box again.
Going back to your yellow box. And many times people go, at my age, it's too late. And again, there's so much research, and I've done a lot of this. Even the very frail. So there was some, not mine, some other, another person's piece of work, that front one, where they looked at care home residents and they were doing high-intensity strength training. And essentially they doubled their strength in 12 weeks. Doubled. So it's never, ever too late. And that's an important thing for you to take on board as well. Yes, of course, they're going to say that. Or you're going to say, I want you to exercise, you know, and preferably do it for 6 months. Say, oh dear, I won't be here in 6 months. You know, all these other things are going to get me first. And you'll have these conversations. But joking aside, it's really, really important that they just embed it into everyday life and maintain it at least. So these are essentially the Otago exercises. We've got 5 strength ones. I only did some balance ones with you just now. So you can either use ankle weights, but actually the frailty of the people you're working with, if they do these without ankle weights, they'll still have a strengthening effect. And we've got your 12 balance ones. Really simple. They're not rocket science. And some of these you're not going to do with everybody. So an example is the figure of eight. because that's working on the vestibular system and turning. And if you know somebody has dizziness on turning, ideally you want to introduce this, but very slowly and only when you're there, because otherwise they'll probably all fall over trying to do it when you're not. So it's very important about which ones you give. But if these get embedded into everyday life, they're not just going to help falls, they're going to help them get out of bed more easily, maybe even get back into using a bath rather than the shower, be able to play with their grandchildren. All these other things are going to come out of it. And it's really quite simple. They just have to do it preferably daily, which is why it's nice to pick something. So if they like looking out their window, yes, they could do 5 minutes of a strength or a balance exercise while they're doing that. That's an important way to look at it. So I think Leanne's now going to give you some case studies to take into groups or to slide. Are we going to slide half the room? We're going to do the care home and half the other? Yeah.